Hey, it's Joe. Mitochondrial health is all the rage right now, and frankly, I'm a big believer. I'm doing everything I can to improve my mitochondrial health, including taking two of the darlings of the internet, methylene blue and urolithin A. As you'll know from past episodes, I've had great success with methylene blue, despite how crazy taking a synthetic dye into my body regularly sounds to me. More recently, and against all the advice I've received from guests on the show, I started taking urolithin A as an experiment, just to see if I could get any benefit. And 2 months in, I cannot say it's been a success. Dang. But the good news is, I have the HealthSpan guys, Rich and Brandon, back for part two to explain the HealthSpan thinking on these two chemicals that they provide to their clients. They walk through all the whys and the hows of the safety and the benefits to be had. This was a really good chat. All right, let's talk to Rich LaFountain and Brandon Fell of HealthSpan. Well, Brandon, Rich, welcome back to our second edition of this deep dive into what HealthSpan can do for people like me. Last time we talked about my blood test results and what I might do to understand them better and improve them. And today, even though you guys do a lot more than just that plus what we're going to talk about today, the two things that I was the most interested in are, one was the blood test, but the other are these two sort of crazy supplements that don't make any sense, which is why I take them. And one of them I have had tremendous results from, I would say, sort of unlike the normal situation of supplements where you don't feel anything, and if you do, it's almost certainly a placebo effect. Methylene blue, it's a synthetic chemical that has a real biological effect on my body, for sure it does. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obvious to me as a caffeine sort of effect that I would have. You could totally feel it. And it's a positive effect, you know, as far as I can tell how it feels. The other one is urolithin A. And this one comes with a lot of really slick marketing and even a good, you know, a lot of good science supported by the company that makes the chemical. I say good, I mean good marketing and maybe good science. I don't know. You guys are the scientists, so I'm interested in understanding what's really true. I've been taking it for about 2 months. I can't really tell anything. I hope it's doing something good for me, but you know, I can't really tell. Maybe it takes longer than that. Maybe I don't need it, and so I don't get an effect because I don't need it. Maybe it's being offset by other things that I'm doing because I'm not just testing one thing at a time like a good scientist. So we're going to dive into those two things, and what order do you think we should do it in?
They're a little bit linked, so I guess up to you. If you want to start with methylene blue, we can do that. But I guess one way to approach it, I guess the way I see these two particular molecules, urolithin A, the supplement, that one helps with mitophagy, helps with promoting healthy mitochondrial cell population or mitochondrial cell organelle population, I guess, to correct myself. Then methylene blue directly targets energy production at the mitochondria. So could be that we start with urolithin A as the supplement, less a prescribed synthetic or medication. That might be my preference, if I have to provide a preference.
All right.
But they are going to overlap, I can guarantee
so
that.
So they're both touching on mitochondria. The urolithin A sounds more like something that is making your mitochondria work better, whereas the methylene blue is more kind of giving your mitochondria that you have a boost that is temporary.
Yeah, there's certainly a differentiation between the two, in that one is a supplement, urolithin A, and one is a prescribed medication, which is what we offer, is the methylene blue as a capsule form too. So there's that distinction to kind of start with. And kind of speaking to your point, yes, both are certainly involved in mitochondrial health. And we talk about autophagy, which is one of the reasons somebody might take something like rapamycin, is kind of this cellular cleaning process that kind of is like a ongoing spring cleaning through that inhibition of mTOR1. But there's a very specific type of autophagy called mitophagy. So whereas we have the cell, autophagy, we have mitophagy, and obviously the mitochondria is sitting within the cell. So taking something like urolithin A kind of promotes that cleaning process specifically of the mitochondria and, you know, addressing any kind of misfolded proteins, damaged organelles, any other kind of cytoplasmic components that might be like bleh, and kind of clears them out and makes way for the healthier mitochondria. And I think that is kind of speaking to this audience in terms of athletic performance, wise athletes, in that you want those to be doing the best job they possibly can be doing as you are training for an event, you know, in the heat of an event. Certainly as we age, there's kind of atrophy of mitochondria and accumulation of the crappy ones. So anything you can kind of do to upregulate the promotion of that mitophagy process is going to be a win for sure. And you probably would see that certainly with your performance. You probably certainly would see that with specific set of lab markers. And we can talk about that a little bit more too, because Rich and I are running a study for methylene blue right now. And I don't want to deviate too far from the urolithin A, but a lot of fun stuff going on as we wear our scientist hats at this point that I think we can kind of unpack a little bit more.
Yeah, let's talk about urolithin A first. We'll get to the methylene blue. All right, so autophagy, everybody's heard of. Mitophagy, probably almost everybody's heard of. You know, we understand that you can kind of boost that by sort of having energy deficits, you know, like fasting is supposedly good for boosting autophagy and perhaps mitophagy as a subset of that. But urolithin A is not that. It's, as I understand it, it's a postbiotic. It's like the result of a bacteria that lives in some people's gut. And so some people have it already. They don't need to supplement it because their body makes it already from certain substrates like pomegranates. But other people don't have this bacteria in their gut, and so they don't make it, or they don't make enough, and so supplementing it does help. Maybe it would be helpful for a layperson, you know, like me, to understand why would this postbiotic that is made by a certain bacteria from a certain substrate cause my mitochondria to get rid of its bad buddies?
Well, I think we can start with kind of where it's a natural compound, like you kind of pointed out. It's found in the pomegranates and the berries and the nuts and all those kind of fun things. And it was first kind of identified in 1980, I think it was, in rats. So we tend to have this kind of reversion to mice and rats and things that ultimately we test in to kind of make it pertinent and safe to take as humans. So like you said, a lot of people don't really produce this enough, the urolithin A, naturally. So even if you have a gut microbiome that supports the urolithin A production, you'd probably need a pretty unrealistic amount of pomegranate juice to achieve kind of the preferred dose, the desired effect that we do by taking something like the urolithin A supplement. So, Rich, I know you have like kind of a metaphor or analogy to taking something like creatine, which I think is fun. And cool.
With anything endogenously produced, I know in this case, technically, it's a, like you had said, Joe, a microbiome or a inhabitant of our gut that is maybe not us, but it metabolizes these elagitannins and then will produce urolithin A, as you mentioned. But yeah, I kind of see it like, you know, creatine is endogenously produced. We get it from our diet, but we usually don't make, you know, we're not getting enough to hit like that optimal range, you know, 5 grams or 3 to 5 grams roughly for like the muscle and performance benefits, or, you know, sometimes even higher, 10, 20 grams on the cognitive side. So I kind of see it that way, the way urolithin A, it's wise to consider it as a supplement. Because if you, like Brandon had said, it's a little bit unrealistic, kind of difficult to achieve reliable urolithin A levels without kind of mainlining the pomegranate juice or something like that. And as you mentioned, Joe, not everyone has the correct microbiome diversity or species, subspecies to produce it. The way it works on mitophagy, there's actually, it's got a dual pathway or a dual mechanism for activating mitophagy. And again, mitophagy, just for a reminder, it's like the selective removal of damaged mitochondria. So old, tired mitochondria, you can kind of keep them around, but their capacity is going to be limited. And ideally, you're going to hopefully clean house a bit, like Brandon had mentioned, to enable you to grab some energy from those mitochondria and breaking them down potentially, but also kind of spare or recycle those raw materials. As you kind of cannibalize those mitochondria, you can rebuild some new mitochondria that are hopefully going to function a little bit better, because there is a life cycle on those organelles. There's the two pathways, as I mentioned. So the one is this P10-induced kinase, or PINK1 PARC-independent. And then there's a PINK1 PARC-independent pathway. But basically, urolithin A serves to allow stabilization of this PINK1 PARC-independent pathway, which further allows for lysosomes to dock to the mitochondria using that LC3 protein, which is an interesting protein just because that is one of the signatures for autophagy. I know autophagy is notoriously hard to measure in humans, but one of the biomarkers for autophagy being upregulated is this LC3. So it allows for the lysosome to have a more successful rate or a more effective binding and then enveloping and decomposing or deconstructing these mitochondria if they're getting a little bit old and tired. So that's kind of the way that urolithin A will help facilitate mitophagy is by allowing those lysosomes to bind.
Yeah, it's a kind of a more proactive approach, right? So like when you would otherwise kind of rely on endogenous signals that respond to stress, it's like you take urolithin A to kind of get ahead of the curve, so to speak, a little bit and kind of clear those guys out that might be old or tired, like you said, Rich, and kind of nudges this mitophagy induction without really any damage. So there's not really side effects or, you know, a bad to it. It's kind of like, you know, if you take your vitamin C or your multivitamin once a day, is it doing something? Maybe, probably. Is it hurting anything? Most likely not.
Okay, so that's interesting. I didn't understand. In fact, I had no idea how it worked at all, but speculated that maybe it was had some sort of like a toxic effect that overburdened the mitochondria and it sort of stimulated them to try to get better, right, by getting rid of their bad buddies. But it doesn't sound like that's the case. It's more like it makes the recycling process easier. It, you know, greases the skids, so to speak, to make that process work.
Yeah.
And so while, maybe I can boost my autophagy and mitophagy by having an energy shortage, you know, I'm not eating or something. I suppose my body is always doing some autophagy. And so maybe this is causing some of the mitophagy to happen more aggressively, more because it's easier. It just is getting more of it done all of the time. But I wonder, is there anything known about ways of, you know, combining urolithin A with fasting or endurance exercise or other mechanisms for stimulating mitophagy? Do they kind of multiply or add up?
That's a good question. I know there is, obviously ongoing work related to the urolithin A. I'm a little bit less familiar with they've done some human studies where they've been able to actually investigate that, especially, again, just given the difficulty in reliably measuring autophagy in humans. In mouse data, and it's a little bit easier because you can usually, you can sack the mouse and then you can actually kind of look at some of these things a little bit more actively using biomarkers or, blood markers or cell samples. You might be able to get a signal there. I guess logistical or theoretical physiological, benefit of urolithin A in combination with some of those either lifestyle habits, exercise, or different things that you might do to promote autophagy would definitely line up. It's I guess one way that I see it is more on the mitophagy side or with the urolithin A. I don't know how this analogy will land, but it's I usually like. Every now and then we just forget to bring the trash and the recycling out to the end of the driveway, and therefore we do not have trash and recycling that's picked up that week. And that's usually a stressor because then we have to figure out what to do for the next week and where we're going to cut or find ways to not make as much trash or recycling. I kind of see a urolithin A is almost like facilitating kind of bringing the trash recycling bin to the end of the drive there so that you can actually have the recycling truck come by or the lysosome, if you will, to help facilitate that process. And certain things like exercise, like you had mentioned, just kind of helping to identify or make that disparity more clear where there's some mitochondria here that are not functioning or operating at max capacity. It might be a little bit easier than in that case for your body to kind of identify them and then work on the autophagy side. But that goes again for, like Brandon had mentioned, the cellular level, but then at the organelle level at the mitophagy for mitochondria specific.
Cool. Okay.
If you think about the electron transport chain, right, there's four components to that. There's four protein complexes and you have to go 1, 2, 3, 4 and ultimately create the ATP. And so if there's like boogers and fluff that are mixed up in between those four complexes, you don't get to that endpoint, which is the ATP production, which then would correlate to probably poor athletic performance and cognitive decline and brain fog and all that fun stuff. So anything you can kind of do to clear up the stuff that lies in between those to allow for that ATP synthase process to happen, which is the final step, which in theory, both urolithin A and methylene blue do swoop in to do, is going to be a win and probably something you would experience with athletic performance for sure.
Okay. My mind has always gone toward athletic performance, you know, muscle performance. And I think the studies that on urolithin A that I've seen, they also tend to focus on athletic performance, you know, whether it's an old person and how, you know, how quickly can they walk, which is of less interest to me than the studies of, you know, athletes who are, you know, how fast can they run or, you know, things like that. But it must be true. Anyway, I'm speculating again, so you guys help me out here. It must be true that urolithin A is not just addressing issues with my mitochondria in my muscles. I have mitochondria in every cell in my body except my red blood cells. And so it must be, if it works at all and it makes my mitochondria upgrade, then I must be upgrading my energy production everywhere, my brain and my liver and, you know, every organ in my body. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely right. There's been mouse studies and there's been human trial studies on this stuff too, that I think it was a 2022 paper that looked at increase in the mitochondrial gene expression. So that was not only there, but ATP production in muscle too. So now we're kind of correlating it to what you're talking about, which is important to you is athletic performance. We've seen studies in older adults as well, where they have improvements in their walking distance. I think it was, Rich, I can't remember, the 6 or the 12 minute walk test. There was improvements in that. There was grip strength improvements. There was kind of fatigue resistance that was published in, I think it was the Nature Metabolism article. Yeah. We've also seen a reduction in a lot of the pro-inflammatory markers. So we're talking about like the interleukins, the TNF-alphas. So, I mean, check, check, check. That's, I think, everything you would absolutely want to have and have happen when you take something like urolithin A or want to see an improvement in your mitochondrial health.
There's a really great Nature paper. If audience would like to take a closer look and kind of a more comprehensive view of urolithin A in particular from 2021, and it was looking at urolithin A in regards to health and healthy aging. Talked a little bit about like the C. elegans data, where lifespan is extended by up to 45%. I know Brandon touched on the muscle, heart, and what you had mentioned, Joe, where it's, you know, certainly mitophagy is one of the primary areas where urolithin A has this direct mechanism, but there was quite a range there. Cartilage degeneration seems to be one area that's being investigated, or at least there's some plausible data there. Immune system function, again, like once you get the mitochondria functioning better, it's really, you know, it kind of forms a cascade, if you will. There's so many other, like organ function improved, obviously athletic improvements like you're interested in, but there is, you know, again, even on like the lifespan extension side of things. So it's, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where this goes. I don't know if it finds its way into the ITP. I'm looking at, you know, specific targets there as well, but the data seems really promising.
Great. That does sound very good. You know, and even if all it was doing was improving my health, then that would improve my athletic performance because I could train harder and recover better. So, you know, maybe if all it did was improve my health, taking it right before a race, maybe that's not the way to make it work. If I take it regularly and up my game everywhere over time, then that's going to help me in my race. Anyway, I guess this sounds like the sort of thing where you don't take it right before an event or right before your workout or right after a workout or I'm trying to recover. It's more like you just take it regularly to improve your mitochondrial function. And if you can do that, if you now have more energy and less waste in the energy production process, then you're going to be healthier. You're going to function more like you did when you were younger, when all of this happened without much intervention.
Yeah, and specifically as it pertains to race day or training for race day, when you have that kind of increased mitochondrial efficiency, that's going to lower your lactate buildup. So you can kind of push the boat even further. So anything you can do to promote mitochondrial health, you're going to certainly experience in terms of your performance.
Okay, and so you guys offer this as a product, one of the few products that you offer. Who do you advise take it? I mean, I guess maybe people get do this sort of preliminary blood test like you guys did for me. And some people are maybe, I don't know, is it some symptom or is it some biomarker or is it just like a, once you get to this age, everybody's suffering from this issue that your Lithium A can help with? When do you advise people do this?
I would say D, all the above. I don't think there's certainly not any kind of drawback or side effect or contraindication to taking it. I think specifically for somebody who is training hard and still wants to do long rides and triathletes and those kinds of things, 100%. As a triathlete myself, I take it. I can't say that I'm like, woo, I took it this morning, I'm going to go run a marathon tomorrow kind of thing. But like, I trust that when I go run 10, 12 miles, that tomorrow I'm going to recover quicker and feel better. And I think I can anecdotally, maybe placebo, say that I've experienced that for sure. If you were to kind of zero in on, I guess, objective markers, if we are going to move the needle in any one direction or the other, you'd probably look at, like I already pointed out, pyruvate lactate. We'd probably look at creatine kinase to kind of indicate any muscle damage, recovery thereof, certainly VO2 max, which would be important for the endurance athlete. And then I pointed out a little bit earlier, like the CRPs, the interleukins, the TNF-alphas, I think we would all expect those things to move in the right direction. We could take it a step further, and I know it's probably not cost beneficial, but something like a Me Screen is a mitochondrial assessment tool that we've paired up with this company, and you send the same way that somebody might finger stick their blood for testing blood sugar or ketones. We send a kit out to these people and they run it through the centrifuge in their lab, and they kind of provide, I think it's about 16 biomarkers in terms of oxidative stress, ATP synthesis, mitochondrial health in general. I know there's a bunch more that I'm probably overlooking, but super cool, super like innovative, very accurate feedback in terms of how well your mitochondria are actually performing. And so if you were to take something like urolithin A or methylene blue and or at baseline and then do this for about 2, 4, 6 weeks, I think you would have some pretty promising results in terms of what your mitochondrial health is looking like.
Right. So who shouldn't take urolithin A? Is anybody?
That's a really good question. Yeah, that's a really good question. The risk-benefit ratio, when you start looking at it, because the side effects are so low, and part of the reason I brought up creatine, or at least I kind of think of it a little bit similar, is these low-risk, endogenously produced supplements, often the risk is fairly low, and therefore the benefits often outweigh the risk. And that's usually the way that we would go about it on an individual level, is for each person based on lab data, based on, their discussions with us. Potentially you'd factor in even more stuff on the individual level, like resources and interest or time or prioritizing various things. For urolithin A, because the benefits seem to be pretty well supported and it's picking up more research over time, and because the risks are so low, most people, if they're interested, we will, discuss this as a possibility for them. Often it then comes down to like, do you want to make the financial commitment? Do you potentially see a reason, or are you like interested, like you are, for example, for someone that's more of a master's level athlete? I think urolithin A makes a ton of sense because you're relying on your mitochondria a lot. For someone that maybe hasn't checked a lot of the other lifestyle boxes, for example, urolithin A probably would help, but I think that sometimes you start with the lifestyle and then you kind of make your way, towards lifestyle, nutrition, improving there. Then you start looking at supplements. Then you might start looking at some of the prescription type medication if we're kind of like triaging where we're going to go in terms of helping people prioritize.
Yeah, we're nutrition and food nerds. So usually that's the first.
Awesome. Okay. So the last question I have is just sort of related to quality of the supplement. You can get this stuff through the internet, you can go onto Amazon and you can find, 20 suppliers of this. Now, I don't know whether they're selling me baby powder and a pill or what, in my personal experience with what I'm taking, which might be baby powder for all I know, the effect is so small or nothing that I can feel. I would have no idea, as long as it didn't make me sick, that there was anything wrong with what I was buying. So how do you guys confirm that what you got? I assume you're not manufacturing it. You're sourcing it from somebody, and you're, I assume, testing it to make sure that it's what you wanted.
100%. Yeah, we have a pharmacy that we work with that does all of that testing and bioavailability testing. So we're certain that 500 milligrams is what you're getting of the urolithin A, and that's kind of like what I would consider the starting dose. And if you push the envelope, and if you're a more heavily training athlete, you can probably push that to the 1,000 milligrams a day. If you look at some of the studies that are out there now, I know there's probably a potential conflict of interest because it's a supplement. I took it. I feel great. I did this, but it's been peer reviewed. It's been published in, I think JAMA, Nature, all the kind of fundings have been disclosed. So I think no real issues there. A lot of it was randomized, double blind, placebo controlled stuff. So that's kind of the gold standard of studies. So I think we trust that it's pretty valid, not shady data at that point. And I think even at that point too, most of them used independent collaborators. So you kind of remove that potential conflict of interest scary that might be there. So you're not probably not taking baby powder.
Yeah, good. I worry about that. Okay. Well, let's move into methylene blue. And so just to recap a little bit, the urolithin A is sort of it should be taking it regularly, and it encourages your body to upgrade your mitochondria, which for most people is probably not optimally functioning, especially older athletes, the older being the key part of that phrase, that your body just doesn't work as well as it used to. And so what little we can do to try to improve that process, if we're already doing endurance exercise and we're having periodic energy shortages, whether through exercise or not eating, then the urolithin A on top of that could be an addition to upgrading your mitochondria over time and all of the time. Your mitochondria will be working better all of the time. So not just your muscles, but your brain function, all of the cells in your body function. Okay, so methylene blue is also dealing with the mitochondria, but it is, as I understand it is not a thing that, as you take it, it helps the structure of your body to be superior, better than it was. Rather that it's more like putting some oil on a hinge. It just works better for a while, and then your body eventually excretes the methylene blue, and you have blue pea. And after, I don't know, it's like 4 hour half-life. So after about 24 hours, there's nothing left in your body anymore. And your mitochondria are no better than they were before you took it, but they did function better while it was in your body. Am I understanding that right?
I agree. That's my understanding. There may be, like on the clinical side, some applications of methylene blue where it actually does shift, like for example, some structural or some cellular function, red blood cell function with methemoglobin anemia and reducing that ferrous iron so that the hemoglobin can become functional. So like on the clinical side, I probably would say there might be some structural benefits of the methylene blue, but on the health, longevity, and mitochondrial side, I'm in full agreement. There is only more or less higher performance of the mitochondria you already have. You're not structurally, shifting your mitochondria, adapting them like urolithin A.
Okay, so you're talking about sort of a traditional use case for methylene blue for like carbon monoxide poisoning, where the
Something
carbon
like that,
monoxide
yes.
is sort of locked in on your red blood cells and you can't get any oxygen because they're bound up with this carbon monoxide, and the methylene blue will knock it off, knock the carbon monoxide off of the red blood cells, and so you don't suffocate. Okay, so we're not talking about that, but maybe we're about halfway through with our time here, so we can't go through the whole history of it, but methylene blue is an interesting story. I actually had a podcast already on methylene blue. And so, it's a very old medicine. I understand it was like the very first synthetic pharmaceutical invented. It was actually invented as a dye to make clothes, but somebody discovered that you could put it in, a cell culture, and it would accumulate. The methylene blue, the dye, would accumulate in the parasite for malaria, and that would help them to identify it, to see, how many parasites there were. And then they discovered that it actually made the parasites weaker and more susceptible to other interventions, like quinine or something that was good for killing them. Anyway, so they sort of stumbled on this weird phenomenon of this dye for making blue jeans was like good for your health. It's like That's nuts. How could that be true? But it was true. As we mentioned, it also helps with carbon monoxide poisoning and maybe some other things. So anyway, you go to the hospital, they've all got methylene blue in there, and they're usually using it in like really big doses. You're going to get it in an IV, and it's a humongous dose to save your life. And that's not what we're talking about. Is that right?
No, sir.
Yeah. So what are we talking about?
Precisely the case. So yeah, for methylene blue, you're exactly right. Synthetic blue dye stains things very well. So we'll probably talk about that with the mode of delivery on methylene blue, because it could be a liquid or it could be troche, it could be a capsule. So we'll get into that. But it's a fascinating molecule with these, you know, this huge range of human applications. So certainly a lot of interest. And like you said, hospitals carry it. Soldiers were carrying it when they went to the Pacific Theater in the like early, you know, like 1900s, World War One, World War II type timeframe, because they didn't have antibiotics like the way we have them now. So it was, you know, that was their antibiotic. So it does have that antimicrobial capacity, as you mentioned, around the malaria. But yeah, it's a synthetic. So I think that's sometimes a concern. I think you mentioned at times the synthetic nature is a bit of a concern for you. Is that correct, Joe?
Oh, well, I hate taking any chemicals into my body that are sort of especially unnatural things in unnatural doses. I mean, I guess everything I eat and drink is a chemical of some sort. But when something strikes me as being sort of like gasoline, you know, then I don't want to ingest it unless I'm going to get some real assurance that, no, this is going to be good. This is going to be good. And methylene blue took some doing. That was very hard for me to get over my hesitation to do it. But I was in a space where I was suffering from brain fog. It was really bothering my life. And I was looking, I was trying things. I tried nicotine. I was, of course, trying caffeine. Everybody does caffeine. You know, eventually caffeine, you try a little more and you lose everything, you know. So caffeine, you know, and now you can't sleep anymore. So you can only do so much caffeine, and the nicotine, I guess I never really quite got much of a dose of that, because I just thought, oh my God, I'm doing nicotine? My God, really? And anyway, so I was looking for something that might help, and I bumped into the company that sells the troches. And so I tried them out, and it actually is a product that has the methylene blue and nicotine and caffeine in it. And so I didn't know what was benefiting me, because it did work. It helped me. And so I then ended up buying some of the liquid, the methylene blue, which again is one of those things like, are you sure what you're getting? Anyway, so I had to look very carefully at the different providers before I selected one. And that was like, miracle juice. Totally stains everything. If you're not careful, your teeth, your mouth, your clothes, your kitchen counter, everything it touches is blue. So be careful if you're going to use a liquid. Yeah. But it totally kills brain fog. And I didn't understand it, but it totally killed it. But over time, other things that I was doing, I think, sort of resolved my mitochondrial issues. And I didn't get brain fog. Yep. So I was only taking it when I had brain fog in the afternoon. And then I essentially wasn't taking it anymore because I didn't get brain fog anymore. But more recently, I have been just taking a smaller dose of it every day. And one of the weird things that has come of that is that I have discovered that my enlarged prostate, which makes it harder for me to empty my bladder, seems to function better on a dose of methylene blue. And the more regularly I take it, the easier it is for me to empty my bladder. So I never heard anybody talk about that. And I've just sort of encountered that randomly myself. Anyway, sorry for a long, winding answer to your question.
That was cool.
No, that was awesome. I have seen some interesting research, in fact, with methylene blue. Again, that antimicrobial benefit. There's some UTI research, some kidney stone research even, that shows some favorable effects. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly that would directly tie to the prostate experience that you've had, but so there is some interesting research there, and obviously it makes sense, like your urine or your pee turns this bluish greenish color, so obviously it's coming in contact with your bladder, and so you're getting some of that methylene blue exposure. I know the prostate thing is a different mechanism, I'm sure, but yeah, that's the closest I can get in terms of like knowing some research around that area where methylene blue does have an interesting or unique, I know we like there's other things that, like, for example, SGLT2 inhibitors, they increase urinary tract infection risk slightly. So methylene blue could be a great maybe option there, where you're getting some of the anti-brain fog benefits, you're getting some of the energetic benefits on the mitochondrial side, but then you're also potentially reducing some of the UTI risk. And even in like menopausal women, that can be something that comes up. So
Well, let's don't leave that subject for too quick, because the SGLT2 inhibitors is something that more and more people are taking. There's supposedly, I mean, they're obviously like a diabetes or pre-diabetes type benefit there, as it causes your kidney to not recapture the sugar that got extracted from the blood, and you just pee it out. Well, so the sugar goes into your pee now, so you've got sugary pee. And that's food for bacteria that might somehow have gotten into your bladder. And now, so it's easier for bacteria to thrive in that urine. So the methylene blue, if it's an antibacterial and it's also in your bladder, it's offsetting the effect of the SGLT2 and putting more food in the bladder for the bacteria. That's what you're saying?
So it's just a more habitable or more hospitable environment for bacteria to live, develop, multiply,
Okay,
all
and
that.
the methylene blue makes it less
And
hospitable.
there's
Yes, it kind of, yep, like you had said. Go ahead, Brandon, sorry.
And then there's certainly a tipping point to that too. There's just like a classic example of more is not better. And it seems to be that when you hit like a 25 to 30 milligram-ish of the methylene blue, it starts to actually cross over. Instead of becoming antioxidant, you're now more pro-oxidant. So you're kind of doing damage at the point. So there's certainly a
Yeah. All right. So let's get back
phone
and
call.
talk about methylene blue. Dosing, how much should people take for what causes, like I have an infection versus I have brain fog or whatever. And do you take it every day, or do you take it when you need it, or that sort of thing? We should talk about athletic performance effects and then risks. Let's just dive in.
Yeah, so we'll, I guess, start with the dosing. Literature range suggests that 0.5 to 4 milligrams per kilogram a day is within the safe range. Most studies tend to favor the 1 to 2 milligram range in terms of like the human data that I've seen, related to like Alzheimer's, cognitive function, those types of things. On the clinical side, you're going to get in that higher, like 3, 4 milligrams per kilogram, up to like 7 milligrams per kilogram. I've definitely seen, on the absolute side of things, dose ranges that are like 200 or 300 milligrams in a day, which is very different than, again, I know we brought up with Urolithin A, this risk benefit ratio, and like you had said, the side effects will kind of compile in here with our dosing discussion. But people are help focused on health and longevity rather than treating disease. They're actually probably best suited at doses that are 1 milligram per kilogram or less. In fact, the way HealthSpan approaches it, after our look at the research, especially related to, some of the cognitive, this seems like a lot of people that approach HealthSpan and they're interested in methylene blue. Some of it's energy, and but a lot of it is like you had mentioned in your experience, it was like a brain fog thing. So we kind of looked in the cognitive space for some of our dosing information, but there's some interesting studies that go back to the 80s where they were testing methylene blue, and they did, because of the blue pea thing, you have to have a placebo or a subtherapeutic dose that also produces blue pea. So they used like an 8 milligram or a 15 milligram dose compared with like that 30, 60, like the higher dose ranges, so that they could have that effective placebo there, or at least what they thought was going to be a placebo. But the results on the cognitive side ended up being pretty similar, even for that lower dose. So our range that we usually offer is between 5 and 25 milligrams. So depending on your body weight, that's roughly 0.1 to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram.
Is that a
So
daily
I
dosage?
guess we usually recommend 5 out of 7 days a week.
Okay.
Just so that, like, there can be, like Brandon had said, like this, you can overdo methylene blue, basically, in our opinion, where that antioxidant benefit becomes less a benefit, and you kind of, there's a U-shaped or a hormetic response. So you can get benefit with methylene blue up to a certain point, depends on what you're after, where this, hormetic response is. If it's like a clinical thing, it's a little bit different, or if brain fog, it's a little bit different. So yeah, we usually do, like, standard is 5 out of 7 days a week. that allows your body a couple days to just kind of like have a little bit of a break, if you will, or cycle where you're not constantly dosing. The other interesting thing that you brought up is more or less the acute or performance or targeted dosing around a specific task, exercise, maybe a cognitive assessment, work deadline or presentation, something like that, where you might target your methylene blue in a more acute fashion. We are getting some incoming about things like that, where, you know, maybe you don't take methylene blue every day, maybe it's a few days a week, or maybe it's just, you know, around certain activities. So that's another thing that I think methylene blue lends itself well to, because of the half-life and because of the really rapid effects. Usually within 5 to 10 minutes of consuming or taking methylene blue, you're gonna feel some kind of effect. Not everyone. Sometimes it's a dose titration thing, but I know that Brandon probably has some experience there. And Joe, you may as well, in terms of like how quickly, I know you mentioned like you feel it pretty quick or almost immediate.
Oh, sure. I guess it takes maybe up to 15 minutes on days where if I, you know, I'm sleep deprived or something and I'm just crashing big time in the afternoon, then I've got more of a hill to climb. It takes longer for the effect to show up. That's not to say that I don't feel it before, but I don't get the benefit yet. It takes 15 minutes for the benefit to show up. But, you know, sometimes it's very, very fast. I don't know if that's a learned placebo thing, or it just can actually happen that quickly. If it's happening that fast, it must be absorbing like through the lining in my mouth, as opposed to going through my digestive system, which would surely take longer than seconds to get into my bloodstream. So I think I understand you to say that, at least my interpretation was that the methylene blue can take more than 24 hours to get out of your system. And so if you're taking it every day, it's going to accumulate. And so you don't really want it accumulating. So taking a day or two off, you're saying maybe a day every 3 days or 4 days or 2 days a week, make sure that you're just getting down to zero and you're not accumulating the methylene blue over time. Even though the dose is so small, it probably is not getting to be like a hazardous dose. Now, when I take it, I'm taking very small doses, you know, 10 milligrams, 20 milligrams, you know, not smaller than that. I'm doing it with an eyedropper. After a year of doing it, I've gotten to where I'm pretty good at not dribbling it down my face or onto my shirt, you know, or onto my teeth. And now people are like, what did you just eat some candy or something there?
Made out with a Smurf.
There we go. Smurf. Yeah. And another thing that I have done that I know that a lot of people do is, in fact, I started by putting it into water, and I'd put some vitamin C powder in the water and it would turn it clear. And it seemed to function exactly the same way, you know, still had blue pea, still had the same energy, brain energy production side effect. But now I've just gotten to where I'm, you know, better with the eyedropper. And so I don't even bother with all of that anymore. Okay. So let's talk about athletic performance a little bit, because one of the side benefits that I thought I would get from it would be, gosh, if my mitochondria are working better, I'm going to get better athletic performance, endurance, you know, aerobic performance. And it has not worked out that way in a way that I wouldn't have predicted. You know, I would have said, I'm going to get that benefit, or I'm not going to notice anything. Well, I do notice something. My exercise feels harder to me when I have taken methylene blue within an hour or before of exercising. My heart rate is low, but it feels harder. I'm not breathing harder. My heart is actually lower than normal. So everything seems to be functioning better, but it just feels harder. So I can't push myself to get that higher performance that I think is there for me to grab if I could just push through the discomfort. It's not a discomfort. It just feels harder. And I actually at first thought it was harder. It wasn't until I was watching my heart rate that I realized, wait a second, my heart rate is down. My heart rate is lower for the same level of effort. So why does it feel harder? I have no idea.
Yeah, that's an interesting, I guess, experience associated with that. I have not done, and I guess we can take a bit of a look at the research, which is unfortunately lacking in human data around exercise and methylene blue. There's a couple studies that I'm aware of. There's one that talks about this calorigenic action of methylene blue it's a more of a case study in a single 9 kilogram dog from 1936. 50 years later, there was another study in dogs, methylene blue. Yeah, 1986, they were doing treadmill work and they did look at cardiac output changes and things. Basically, they found that they were in testing a saline plus exercise versus methylene blue plus exercise plus methylene blue at rest, there was really no change in any of the cardiac output measures. So having a lower heart rate might be maybe more of like, you know, a human thing or a Joe thing, not so much associated with the dog data. In both of those cases with these dog studies, they did show or report that there was this shift. And I think Brandon mentioned like this lactate to pyruvate ratio. So at rest, methylene blue reduce this lactate to pyruvate ratio, basically meaning that you're doing more aerobic ATP production. So around your like your rating of perceived exertion, or like you're feeling as if the exercise is harder. I'm wondering a couple things. Maybe this brain fog clarity, you know, might be allowing you to like sense, feel, perceive this exercise a little bit more difficult than if you're a little bit less methylene blue, more foggy during your exercise, where you're kind of like not feeling as intensely or as sensitively the challenge associated with the exercise. The other would be around this shift basically towards more aerobic ATP production. So if you're doing more high intensity exercise and this methylene blue is kind of like pulling your body towards more aerobic ATP generation, it may feel like there's a bit of a blockade or a hurdle there, if you will, where it's kind of limiting your ability to get to like that fourth, fifth gear where you're like, you know, hitting that more anaerobic metabolism rate. And so there could be some of that going on. I know this is not the exact same thing, but I know we come against this. I've done like clinical exercise testing in the past a number of years ago, and like people on beta blockers, we could get them to a max or close to a max, at least to a diagnostic threshold during a stress test. But it was usually a challenge, and we kind of like got hung up for a little bit for like a stage or a stage and a half, where like we had to kind of like coax them or coax their body, their heart into this higher gear. I wonder if methylene blue puts a little bit of like a sticking point in there, if you will. There's also some mouse data, but I guess it was a 2024 study. And it, again, we need human studies on this. So we are doing a pilot study on methylene blue. It is not exercise focused. We are probably at Healthspan in need of an academic partner to join and partner up with us to basically assess some of this methylene blue and exercise participants, people like yourself, Joe, or other people in the Healthspan community are exercisers and do kind of check the lifestyle boxes and then add on some of this, you know, supplements and molecules like methylene blue. It would be wonderful to actually have some real human data, but yeah, I looked through everything I could and I found some dog data, some mouse data, and not a lot on the human side. So it's anecdotes at this point.
Well, I think that, my experience was that I took a gamble. I tried it. It really helped me with the brain fog. My understanding is that it improves your mitochondrial output wherever it is needed. So you will feel it first where you need it most, even though it's happening everywhere, because you can't just, the methylene blue doesn't know to go to my brain because I have brain fog. It just goes everywhere in my body. But if I'm having brain fog, that's where I'm having energy production issues. And so I feel it there first. Anyway, so, my thought on this is, hey, you know, I mean, unless you've got some issue, you know, like, and I don't even know that this would be true, but if you've got like a damaged liver or damaged kidneys or something that you're worried about, you know, killing, you know, pushing just a little bit too far, then this is one of those things that it's worth trying little doses and just see how it goes. And then if you're using it for some purpose, you know, like for me, it was the brain fog, then you can try it with your athletic performance too and just see how it goes for you. And maybe what I need to do is not let the feeling of it being harder stop me. Maybe I just need to really push and get through that hurdle, through that little friction point, and see if I can get to the other side. And maybe I will have an athletic benefit if I just can push myself through there, which I haven't done. I've just said, it just feels weird. I'm not going to do the methylene blue before I exercise anymore. But maybe I've just, been chicken and I just got to push a little harder. So I will do that. I'll report back on that for sure. Okay, so you guys are offering a different form factor. Because, I mean, I talked about the troche, which is a little like lozenge that you put in your mouth. And you can swallow them, or you can just let it dissolve in your mouth and absorb through your cheek lining to get into your bloodstream. And there's the liquid, which is, I think, the most common thing that I've seen, and that you can put in water with vitamin C, or just put in water, or, you know, you do what I do and you just eyedropper it at the back of your throat. But you guys are you have it in sort of a pill form. How do you do that?
Yeah, we do a capsule. Brandon, it looked like you were about to speak, and I feel like I don't want to cut you off all the time here.
No, you're good. it's a capsule. I think what we consider is the starting dose is 5 milligrams per day for that 5 days a week that Rich mentioned a little bit earlier. Ability to go up to 25 milligrams is what we kind of consider our ceiling in terms of prescription. I think we find that there's a pretty substantial kind of sensitivity to this stuff, and maybe you've experienced that, Joe, either with taking it yourself or with combination with the nicotine and combination with the caffeine. Some people take the 5 milligrams and it's like, going to run through a wall. Like, that's too much for me. And some are like, I felt nothing. I'm going to try the 15, the 20, the 25. And I think that's kind of important consideration, just to kind of check in with us on a regular basis and make sure that, you know, how are you tolerating it? What's going on? What are you feeling? And we can kind of move it from there. What I'm finding as kind of the first person that vets these intakes when they come to us for methylene blue specifically is that there are a ton of people that are also taking SSRIs or an SNRI or some kind of antidepressant, Zoloft, Wellbutrin, blah, blah, blah. Super contraindicated. That's a major safety concern for serotonin syndrome specifically. So unfortunately, you know, have to turn those people away unless they are, you know, willing to work with their prescribing physician for that to kind of titrate off. Or, you know, we can kind of introduce potentially the urolithin A as a same but different kind of approach at that point too. So it's not a hard no, but you should definitely not be taking the methylene blue if you're taking an SSRI or an SNRI.
Yeah, I've heard that before. But I'll share that I recently had heard from the fellow I had on the podcast a year ago about the methylene blue. He says that the SSRIs are not a contraindication, really. Only if you're doing like IV doses. If you're doing big doses of methylene blue, then yes, there's a risk. But if you're doing little tiny doses like we're talking about here, he says that there's no risk, and that, anyway, this is he's a medical doctor. This is his opinion and what he does with his clients. Yep. And also that he says that the methylene blue can have a similar effect as the SSRI medications. And he works toward getting his clients off of the SSRIs and using methylene blue instead, because they get the same sort of mood effect from the methylene blue as the SSRIs. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'll just throw that out there.
Yeah, certainly not a doctor, but I would agree with that completely. And I think, you know, we're also seeing people that are, you know, taking regular low dose, some kind of Adderall, that I think they'd probably potentially achieve a similar effect with taking the methylene blue. So hopefully TBD on that. Yeah.
So what about issues? Go ahead, Rich.
No, I was just going to say that I really enjoyed this. I believe you're probably talking about the Scott Schur episode. I really enjoyed listening to that. He's really awesome. And he does the troche versus the capsule. I have seen some of that research where like the SSRI risk is kind of on the low end, but just in like the telemedicine context for us, we more err on the side of lower dose with most of our approaches. And then, yeah, the contraindication for us ends up being SSRI. But yeah, it's a slightly different, and I love that actually, that Dr. Schur kind of has like that gas clutch thing going on where like you can kind of like remove the SSRI and like press down on the methylene blue potentially, where you can kind of like replace the one with the other, especially just given the risk benefit ratio from my perspective probably is in more favor of the methylene blue if you get a similar serotonergic, you know, effect in terms of the mood state.
Sure. Well, I can tell you when I have brain fog, I'm not in a good mood. So fixing my, making my brain function better helps in a lot of ways. Okay. So we didn't talk at all about, and maybe you guys don't even support like the use of methylene blue for like infections. I mean, one of the things that I'll do, if I feel something like, I wonder if I'm starting to come down with something, or I've got a scratchy throat or something, I just take methylene blue. And I'll take it like a couple of times during the day. And I don't know whether it was because an allergic reaction to something, or the methylene blue actually did something, but man, I never get sick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess on the acute side, that again, that we're kind of just now, and it maybe it's just like a, you know, the state of the field or the state of methylene blue in general. People are more experienced, more exposed to it, like yourself. You're finding these cool, unique ways that you use it. We are seeing some of that, and there is the research, like the again, like the antibacterial, antiviral, that's been known back to like the soldiers carrying it into the Pacific Theater for, you know, antibiotic alternative. For UTIs, again, methylene blue is recommended in a few papers. There's actually like different things that you can do that are not antibiotics. So methylene blue kind of performs that similar function. And I think there was some cool study. It was a French study from 2020. It was 2,500 patients. They are all cancer patients, but they happen to be on methylene blue and reported no cases of like the SARS-CoV-2 infection or COVID as we know it. So there certainly is application for that. I think that's yet another benefit of methylene blue, to just kind of add to this myriad of like very unique ways this really cool synthetic has these, like you're saying, these true, real biological effects. There's such a wide range. And again, if you can get that risk-benefit ratio in the right balance, then it's really cool to just kind of stack up these really, you know, unique improvements in various things, you know, some mitochondrial, some cognitive. That's kind of the basis for, you know, why people start with methylene blue. But again, like the acute, I just need a little boost potentially for exercise. I know your experience, and I guess on the target of exercise, since we brought it up again, push through that little hurdle or that sticking point safely. I guess I should probably, you know, I know you will, but just because I don't want to have you like, you know, super push, and I know about you and how hard you probably work and push through things. So yeah, push through that safely if you can, to figure out if that's like a real wall or just like kind of this perceived wall where you have to like try to overcome it. There are some like notable YouTubers that have said their high intensity exercise performance increases a bit, but it's like N of one YouTube data. So it's data. I'm not discounting that, but it is, you know, sure, maybe not the peer reviewed type.
Well, we're on the bleeding edge in this stuff here. And so, you know, self-experimentation is the only answer. Or, you know, you can wait until your grandchildren are old before there's like scientific proof of what's going to work. Anyway, I mean, there's plenty of things. I mean, almost everything I have ever tried to get some sort of health or athletic performance benefit has been a bust. And I no longer do it anymore. So you got to kiss a lot of frogs, you know. And you're and you'll be lucky if you find any princes. But methylene blue is a prince. I'm a big believer in it, and I am always trying to shrink my load of, you know, chemicals, concentrated and synthetic chemicals that I'm putting into my body. I'm always trying to reduce the load, but methylene blue has a place there forever. That's my current opinion anyway. All right. So what else should we tell people about methylene blue before we wrap this up?
I guess since you brought up the synthetic thing again, I know I've had a similar aversion to synthetics and like this non-natural, non-endogenous. But I guess the thing I would mention there is like that we live in this modern synthetic environment. I think Dr. Scott sure kind of mentioned the same thing. There's some research out there, which is quite fascinating, bordering on like scary, but some research estimates that people eat like roughly a credit card or 5 grams of microplastics, or ingest this, you know, unintentionally every week, leading to roughly like 50 plastic bags a year in terms of like the equivalent of microplastics consumed. So yeah, I'm not in favor of more synthetics just for the sake of having more synthetics, because we certainly have more than we probably want or need and are just living on planet Earth at this point in time in history. So, but I guess the fear of synthetics in terms of methylene blue, in my opinion, it would be obviously a perfect world. Like you don't have microplastics, but you also judiciously are able to determine and consider methylene blue if it's right for you. I think that some fear of synthetics is warranted. But I think, like you had said, in the case of methylene blue, it's just a really cool, fascinating synthetic that happens to have a lot of really positive biological benefits. So it's, you know, it's very different than the traditional synthetic that I think people first think of. It's like, oh, well, this is like this man-made thing that's going to accumulate in my body and make me, my health go to garbage. And yeah, so that's one thing. And then the other, I guess, is around doing your own testing, titration, working with someone that can help you with labs and that type of stuff is really important with any of these urolithin A potentially, but certainly something like, prescription related, like methylene blue.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not a naturalist by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm focused on trying not to take chemicals every day or eat the same things every day. I mean, I've even come to the opinion that eating blueberries every day is a mistake. No human being prior to refrigeration and air travel ever ate blueberries every day of their life. So I don't know. If you're going to do that, that's an experiment. You should take good notes and see how that works out for you. And let me know. Because I'd love to eat blueberries every day, but I just don't believe that that's good for me. So anyway, and synthetic dyes, probably less so than blueberries. But still, I have found personally good experience with methylene blue. I'm happy to take days off. I think that's good for my body to, be able, if it is doing a little damage here and there, that it get my body gets a chance to recover from that. And it's not accumulating and all of those other things. And, and if I was taking 100 supplements, it would be really hard to try to, manage all of that. What day do I take what thing with what other thing, but avoiding taking it with these sets of things, with what foods or no foods. I'd need to have a permanent AI module carried around with me all the time just to alert me to, here are the 14 things you got to take now, and then the 14 things I got to take in an hour, and but I got to eat that with fat, and this I got to eat on an empty stomach. Anyway, so I keep my limit to 10 things. I'm taking 10 things, and I don't take them every day. And one way that I do that is that I have a holiday. I don't take supplements or pharmaceuticals on the weekend. And that just sort of enforces a holiday and gives my body a chance to recover just in case, because I, what do I know?
We're all learning.
Yeah.
I like it.
All right. End of one. All right. Good. Well, let's wrap it up. Tell us again about how we find HealthSpan and how we look into your capsules of methylene blue, which won't stain and won't discolor your face and urolithin A.
You can go to gethealthspan.com and you will see a list of all of our protocols, all the labs that are associated with each one of those protocols, and the markers that are associated with each one of those labs to kind of, we want data, right? So anytime that you take something, let's make sure that we're kind of pairing it up with some of these labs to make sure you are moving in some kind of direction, hopefully the right direction. And we take great pride in what we had kind of done with you last week, Joe, was reviewing those lab panels and kind of going into depth in those and making sure that we're customizing things to make sure it works as best as possible for you and whatever your health goals might be.
Yeah. A tremendous service that I'll say, I'll even give HealthSpan credit for getting me on the right path to doing longevity the right way. And so I'm a big fan of HealthSpan. Glad to have you on the show.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
you. Our pleasure.
All
Yeah,
right. All
awesome.
right, guys.
So great to hang out with you.
All right, guys. You have a good one.
You
All right,
do too.
bye-bye. Thank you so much for joining my talk with Rich and Brandon. You can find more information about how to get in touch with the HealthSpan team in the show notes.